coming up next on Lutheran Radio UK.
Worth doing badly.
Welcome back to Worth Doing Badly with me, Jamie Krieger, and David Weber. This coming Sunday, we will be celebrating the sixth Sunday after the Epiphany. And the lessons for this Sunday are Deuteronomy 30, verses 15 through 20. The Psalm is 119, verses 1 through 8. The Epistle is 1 Corinthians 3, verses 1 through 9. And the Gospel lesson is from Matthew 5, verses 21 through 37. David, welcome back.
Well, it's good to hear from you again, Jamie.
It's good to hear your voice. So let's begin with the Gospel. What's there for us?
This is, in my mind, one of the Gospels that's hard to understand, very difficult to like, and one that I think holds a lot of promise if we can understand the connection between Jesus's severity in explaining the commandments. Particularly, he explains the fifth, sixth, and eighth commandment. And to see that that severity is meant to actually ignite in us a desire for eternity. And it's done in a way which is subtle and complex. And so the first thing we have to work our way through is to see that the severity that Jesus interprets these commandments with is to demonstrate to us that obedience to the commandments is impossible, but not that obedience is irrelevant. The law is impossible to obey in Jesus's thinking because he does not make a distinction between the thought of anger and the act of murder. And that he interprets adultery as both the lustful thought that comes with out any invitation, as well as the adulterous act. This doesn't mean, however, that just because obedience is impossible, that it is futile. Jesus did not teach that hateful thoughts ought to be punished like homicide. And he didn't teach us that lustful thoughts are the cause for divorce. Anymore, if you read further, that he didn't teach us that promising is sinful, and he did not advocate disfiguring the body. So Jesus is using an interesting way of approaching teaching in showing how things are similar and how they're different. So again, we have to ask ourselves the question, why does he ratchet up the severity of the law so that even the teachers of the law recognize that how he sees the law is far more demanding than the way that they had taught it? And the first thing we have to remember is from a couple of weeks ago that Jesus declared he did not come to abolish the law, but to fulfill it. And to fulfill us through the law. So that's the promise. Whatever Jesus does, it is not going to be something that treats the law lightly. It treats it with the utmost seriousness. And I have to say, I oftentimes think that when I teach on forgiveness, people are hearing me say the law does not matter. If we can't actually obey the law, then it must not have all that importance, and forgiveness somehow diminishes the importance of the law, when in fact, that would be horrible news for us. Jesus is saying forgiveness actually allows us to let the law do its work in our lives, because the severity of the law points beyond guilt and shame and condemnation. The severity points to a perfection that all of us desire. So if we go back to Jesus' teaching about lying, you ask a victim of betrayal whether he or she thought that that act of lying And the inner thoughts that led to that act of lying are the same thing. The victim would say, yes, they are the same thing. They're just on the same continuum. Or someone who's been victimized by another person's anger or lust, ask them if they wish that the inner passion that gave rise to the destructive act, if they wish that that inner passion had been taken care of. You see, Jesus interprets the law severely, but so do victims of the offenses that Jesus is talking about. So someone who has been victimized by these things sees a connection between the thoughts and the inner machinations that give rise to the acts. And so they see them similarly. So when Jesus says that it interprets the law with this severity, he is showing that fulfillment of the law is not simply changing outward acts. The fulfillment of the law's demands is changing all of us and for all time. This means that forgiveness does not take sin lightly. Rather, it combats the sin with a passionate seriousness that, as I've mentioned before, the victims of sin actually have. They wish that that sin had never taken place in thought, word, or deed. So, as I said earlier, I sometimes think that when I'm teaching on forgiveness and grace, that the hearers don't think of the law as having a severity anymore. For them, Jesus's forgiveness somehow abolishes the law, and that seems like a kind of freedom, because if there is no law, we don't have shame, and we don't feel condemnation. But there's something else there. To abolish the severity of the law is to make believe that all of us do not have the desire for eternal perfection, and I think that is the one thing that we all have together, is that we are never content with anything less than perfection. Let me give you my go-to example. Who would settle for the iPhone 1 when the iPhone 70x7 has been released? You see, if we just look at the history of technology, whenever there is progress towards tech perfection, it creates the sense of inferiority and makes us unsatisfied with the present technology that we have. You see, in technology, we when we see that something gets closer to perfection, we desire it. We're the same kinds of people, that we want the absolute best that's available, and we don't even know what that absolute best is until we actually see it. Jesus already sees us, and he sees that the law points us to the perfection that we desire, and we want that to be severe, but we're so afraid of it because we feel that the law being impossible to obey, somehow the only way we can live with it is by making believe that it doesn't make the demands that it does, but that is the loss of hope. And so what we have here is Jesus saying that when he comes to earth and he fulfills the law, he fulfills it in its utter demand, so that now we can take seriously the intention of salvation to bring us into the very perfection that the law points us to. So, you know, it's a tough task. Working through, for the sake of the congregation, what grace means and what perfection means and what Jesus means in this particular text that seems to be so severe, and yet what it does is it leads us into it ignites our desire for the perfection that we truly desire, but we just give up on, because we think that it's not attainable. It's not attainable for us, but it's attainable as a gift. So again, then we go moving to the psalm, and we ask ourselves, what would it mean to pray the truth that we see in the gospel? And the psalm makes it very clear that what I saw in Jesus' teaching, when it says, happy are those whose way is blameless. So here you have the severity of the law, the blamelessness, those who walk in the Lord's teachings, but the psalm is explicit. There's not a sadness to the severity. There is a happiness. There is a joy in those who are able to see God's precepts and recognize that those precepts engage the whole heart, that they are the ones, these precepts are the things that allow us to be on the path of life, the making our way through this life with all of its various pitfalls and temptations, and with the happy hope that this life is not finally ending in disappointment, but ending in our fulfillment. But that fulfillment happens because the law has been fulfilled. And so at the end, the psalmist says, this blameless walk, this way of the law can be celebrated with all my heart because it, the totality of the heart is expressed, not perfectly. The law can't do all the work. The law simply, in its way, expresses our desires. It does not itself fulfill those desires. That's why, we're on this Epiphany Sunday, we're looking at the work of Jesus. All right. So at any rate, the psalmist does say that there is a happiness connected with the kind of severity that Jesus is interpreting the law with. So I look at it this way. The word way is used in the psalm several times, and the way, another synonym for it is that it's a path. So if we ask ourselves the question, when would we welcome the severity and clarity of the law? When would that be something that we would be happy about? And having done a lot of backpacking in the wilderness, I immediately was drawn to the times when I was lost and confused as to where I was. And what I really, really desired at that time was some clear directions that told me exactly how I needed to get back to the right path. So if we look at our lives and the times that we have felt lost on the way, we need the clarity of the law and the severity of its interpretation to alert us that we are on a wrong path. But Jesus adds something to that severity. There is an invitation to bring us back to the right path. There is a loving forgiveness that's saying, yes, you're on the wrong path. But that acknowledge that, and then you're back on this right path. You are moving towards the perfection that you actually desire. So there's something, if we just listen a little bit deeper to those severe and clear interpretation, there is a lovely invitation. As I said, the psalmist says it makes one happy to note that one can be on walking on this way, and there we have this light that enlightens our path. So this happiness, I think, goes back to I imagine what would Israel have thought of God's severity in the commandments when they were in captivity. When they look back on with shame on the things that they had taken for granted, the things they had overlooked that had led to their captivity, would they not have thought or wished that they had paid attention to the severity, the clarity of the law? Of course they would. That's how all of us are. But the thing about that severity is when they're in captivity, it wasn't as if that severity continued to condemn them. No, that was a clear sign inviting them back that, yes, they had made errors. Yes, they had put this upon themselves. And yet, because God was still addressing them with the law, with this clarity, all was not lost. The law could again be fulfilled and not abolished, that the alienation they were suffering in being in captivity and being exiled, God's law actually was an alert to them that he intended to intervene in such a way that he would put an end to their shame. Their exile would not be their permanent condition. And that's the message that gets through the law. And then when Jesus comes, we realize just how far God was going to go in making sure that the law was not abolished, but that it was fulfilled. And then this takes us to Deuteronomy. That, again, it sounds like it's very severe, that God says, I have set before you today life and good and death and evil. So God is very simple. There are two paths that we can walk. The one path we're on naturally, and that leads to death. And that way is characterized by the triumph of evil. When evil has done its best work, it leads to a death in which there is no hope for any more life. But there's an alternative way. And that alternative way is a way that also leads to physical death, but it leads beyond that to life. And that means what characterizes that person's life is not the evil that happens, but the good that takes place is the sign of the our future. And this is very sacramental. Every bit of good that we experience in this life is not something which reinforces our sadness that the good does not last. No, it is the good in our life that lasts. It's the evil that's passing away. And so the focus is very different. The way of life sees that the good, even though we would like much more good than we have, that good is the sign that we are on a path of ever increasing life rather than the path of ever diminishing life. So one of the things that I think is a problem that we oftentimes do not see the path of life as attractive. Oftentimes the path of life looks like it's the opposite of that life, that is going off in the wrong direction. And this is because the path of life is sets up bitter resistance against our self-centeredness. Again, thinking back of Israel in exile, they would have seen that they were in exile because they had become self-centered and had given up seeing their life in the light of God. And so part of the path of life is God's intention on decentering us. And that is not easy. And in this passage in Deuteronomy, we see one of the ways that God decenters us by teaching us to love what the writer says the seed, or by paying attention to our offspring, and to see that it's possible to love someone other than ourselves more than we love ourselves. And so the focus here is on the act of love is the thing which is so decentering of us. And that act somehow mysteriously is experienced in this world when we pay attention to the next generation, to our seed, to our offspring. That when we have our first baby, I don't know if you remember your first babies, but I kind of remember it as a boot camp of self-denial. All of a sudden, there was someone on earth that was demanding to be in the pride of place and wouldn't allow us any peace if the child was unhappy. So it doesn't look like life, but what's happening is that my life is actually being enlisted to advance the life of another. It is the way of life. But it is not the way of my life. It's the way of a brand new life that needs me to be unselfish. And that is a kind of a natural image of the supernatural work that God is doing in us in bringing about the life that he has given to us decentering ourselves so that life goes out into the world. Now, when I think about this path, the two paths that are set before us, the path of life and good and the path of death and evil, I think of the two masks that are associated with the theater in Greece. The one is crying, which represents tragedy, and the other is laughing, which represents comedy. And it's not the kind of thing that we think of with Comedy Central, which is a bunch of jokes that aren't really funny. The tragedy and comedy are a way of seeing the whole path of life. The way of death is tragic, and yet that way begins seemingly happy. But then along the way, life inexplicably falls apart, and it ends with a lot of deaths, if you read the tragedies. The way of comedy, things are in a mess at the beginning. They are coming apart at the seams, but somehow, by some surprise intervention, all's well that ends well. So there is a comic story in the Old Testament with Abraham and Sarah and Isaac. Isaac's name actually means to laugh, which looks like a tragedy. It looks like God has made promises he's not going to keep. It looks like that once God keeps a promise, he's going to pull it away by calling for the sacrifice of Isaac. But in the end, everyone is spared, and there is a lot of life going on there, but life is being passed on, where God puts into our imagination the recognition that a beloved son is going to have to die in order for the way of life to be open. But it won't be Abraham's son. The only one who can sacrifice his beloved son is God himself. And that's why laughter is such an interesting part of the story of Abraham and Sarah and Isaac. So the way of life is best captured, not that it's filled with, you know, glee and happiness all the way. It's rather that he who laughs last laughs best. That's what we're holding out for. That's what our hope is. And that's why in Jesus' interpretation of the law, he recognizes that we will not be satisfied with anything less than perfection. Now, St. Paul takes it a little bit differently. And when he asks the question, are you not being merely human? What a question. Are you not being merely human? See, Paul uses the context of a petty argument. And he recognizes that petty arguments always are overly fixated on the things of this earth and not paying attention that we are on a path to transcend this world. We are on a path to be something more than merely human. To be content with being merely human is to be content with an iPhone 1 when you could have a near-tech perfection. No one is ever happy with mediocrity when they see the possibility of perfection. This is what I imagine the weeping and gnashing of teeth being, is that not seeing that God's intention for us was a perfection that we ourselves desire. Paul does not deny the glory of our humanity. Paul is not inhuman. He's not a robot. He's not a pure angel. Rather, he sees that the real glory of our humanity is that it is a stage on a way in which we become more than human. The word is godlike. It was used a lot at that time, but it wasn't used in the same way that Christians used the word godlike, or it's contracted to godly. At that time, the Greek and Romans thought that God-likeness was more like the strength that was manifested in the Olympics or in the academy. So to be God-like was to have the power of the intellect or the power of muscles. Paul sees God-likeness in the ability to pass on life to another person. There's something God-like, procreative, when a couple has a baby. And that becomes an image of a godlikeness of the capacity we who have life to pass it on to others. This is why there's so much care and concern for the poor, for those who have been deprived, is that we actually can exercise a godlike quality in the lives of people by passing on the life that has been given to us and to on to them. Paul sees it as this. It puts it in the terms of food, and he says, "Look at you, and you're being so satisfied with just milk. When in fact, if you look at the menu, there's so much food left for you to try and to enjoy. Don't be content with the small things. Grow up and grow beyond the pettiness and become really recipients of this life, and then really enjoy that life by passing it on to others." And so Paul says, why be content with being merely human? Or we might call ourselves mortal, but we have to remind ourselves that the word mortal comes from the Latin mortus, which means death. Or that human comes from the Latin humus, which means dirt. Paul says, your pettiness, you are reducing yourself to nothing more than mortality and humility of death. That's not who you are. God is addressing you as an eternal being on a path to eternal life. Don't be content with the merely human. So the severity of Christ's interpretation is alerting us not to be content with the petty life that leads to death, but to actually aspire for the perfection that comes by way of promise. And now that puts us at the very precipice of Lent. The next week we deal with Lent, the first Sunday in Lent, in which we give 6 weeks, not to ourselves, not to the things that take place in our lives, but rather our focus is all on the work of Christ and how he came not to abolish the law, but how he fulfills it. And in fulfilling the law, he fulfills our desire for life. And especially that desire that we pass on that life for the life of the world. So that brings us to the end now of the Epiphany season, Jamie.
Thank you very much, David, for sharing these wonderful thoughts with us. And like you said, Lent is upon us, and we will be narrowing into the fact that the severity of the law was imputed to Jesus, but the leniency, the geniality, the blessedness of this exchange, Jesus crucified for us, no matter how comical it may sound to reason, is ours. This wonderful exchange is ours through faith, which is, as you said, the path of life and good to live by and to enjoy, and it keeps on giving. That brings us to the end of this week's episode, and we will be back with you again next week. Until then,